Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 9, The Green Council. It's the feedback episode. Aaron, how's that feedback looking?
The feedback, Jim? Jesus.
Ugh.
Come on.
Why
now?
You got to do this to me?
I thought we were going to try to move past this. It was swole. It was swollen.
Yeah?
Turgid. Yeah.
I think you got to soak those feet. And then if they're all swollen and turgid, yeah. Soak them.
Yeah, throw the whole email bag, feed bag into a tub of Epsom salt.
Yep.
See what
make
happens.
Make email tea.
That would definitely kill Diana. So we got a lot of feedback. Important note, we had a little referendum on leal versus non-leal, and I kept a little tally as I was working through feedback and got stuff, and 11-1, the leal people of the realm have spoken. They want the podcast to keep it leal.
Oh, okay. Great.
Note, special note on that, if you go to merch.baldmove.com, you can buy a Keep an Allele t-shirt in green and yellow Hightower colors or black and red Targaryen colors. How about that? You can keep it leal to either Team Green or Team Black.
I like it.
At merch.baldmove.com. All right, enough hawking. Let's get on to the first feedback message. HotD@baldmove.com, by the way, is where you send, that's the hotline to get consideration for this week's cast. We got a whole bunch of stuff. We got some general notes. We got some Beast Beneath the Board truthers that think there's more to this story. We got some defenses of Otto Hightower. We got some defenses of Rhaenys, or as we like to call her, Rhaenys. And then we also have our Council of Blacks and Council of Greens. So let's get to it. Matt's up first. Says, an important thought about your musing on twins. Remember we said, how weird is it that identical twins get onto the baddest ass bodyguard team on Planetos?
And yeah, the short list.
Matt says, you're correct, of course, that most twins do not reach equal heights of achievement, just as most siblings do not. But there are many examples of what you might call combat sports. Of twins pushing each other to extreme heights on, and this is the key, the same path. Something about ceaselessly fighting someone exactly your same size as a kid seems to be an advantage. That would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like the ultimate shadow, you know, shadow match, right?
Sure.
Mirror match. In boxing, there is the Klitschko brothers of Ukraine, both champions and now leading the real actual war. Interesting. Got Jermell Charlo and Jermall Charlo, but perhaps the pair I think of most for Eric and Arik are Tom and Terry Brand from Iowa. They're identical twins and real wrestling megastars. Their ceaseless, most people would say psychotic sibling rivalry to push them each other led them to multiple state titles in high school, multiple national titles in college, Olympic team success, gold and silver between them. And now they're each the head coach and associate head coach at Iowa and won the national title last year. This wasn't the only one. I got like four different ones, all with unique sightings of people who, especially in sporting contests, tend to or not tend to. It's not unheard of, I would say. So
I feel like they're doing it wrong. I feel like instead of competing, you should work together. Like imagine if Joey Chestnut had an identical twin. Joey Chestnut being the hot dog eating champion of the world.
Thank you. Because I didn't know.
Okay. Joey Chestnut gets like halfway through his eating challenge and then, you know, ducks under the table. And then, oh, here comes Bo Chestnut to finish off that plate, right? Like,
sure.
Not that Joey needs the help. He's doing pretty good on his own. But
what they need to do is have some unethical doctor sew, I don't know, like they're
oh no,
left and right butt cheeks together so they're conjoined twin and they can eat for one.
Okay.
But yeah, the like duck beneath the table and another guy, you know, it's like, hey, I dropped something, whoop, and another guy pops up, ah, I can eat twice as many hot, yeah, that's that's the real deal. I just need, it's too late for me to sire twins, but someone out there, get on that. Vanessa, why do Luke and Jake have nicknames? Jace, rather. The show portrays the brothers as very likable, as you say. The show is leaning towards Team Black. How better to endear the boys to the audience than to give them nicknames? We typically give nicknames to those we feel affection for, so the show is using that trick of psychology to their advantage. Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's the way, because these nicknames are book canonical. But I think they're on to something. That even Martin seems to be maybe putting his thumb a little bit on that side of the scale, if this theory is true. What do you think of it, Jim?
Yeah, that makes sense. I definitely don't give nicknames to my enemies. I don't have many enemies, but probably wouldn't give them nicknames.
So there you go. They're psychologically conditioning us to think of them as the good old boys, in contrast to this Aegon. They could call him Egg if people liked him.
Mm-hmm.
Daemon, you could call him Momo, Mondo, Amo.
Uh-huh.
And Helena, Helen. Yeah, Hell. Come on, Helen. Hell, even better. Lena? Moving on to Ian, you mentioned Rhaenyra having bastards being treason and compared to the Cersei's bastards of Jaime. I have doubts about this, as Rhaenyra is the heir herself with the royal blood flowing through her and they are her children. So it isn't at all like Cersei having bastards and pretending that they were the king's blood. The closer comparison is Bobby B having bastards all over the place, which no one seemed to care about. That wasn't seen as treason. I guess the difference is he didn't try to pretend they were his true-born heirs. Ding, ding, ding. I had never considered the potential treason of her children's alleged bastardhood, so this was an interesting take for me. Also, though, as the king, wouldn't Viserys proclaiming them as his true-born sons and heirs legitimize them anyway? There is precedent for Targaryen kings to have legitimized their bastards. This later note is true. But the one that I can think of, Aegon IV, legitimized all of his royal bastards on his deathbed, and it did not go well. The resulting Blackfyre Rebellion is the second most destructive thing to Targaryen rule, save the Dance of the Dragons we're about to partake in. So,
wow,
he got the moniker the Unworthy for all that Aegon IV did. I think that we've already answered a question within the email that, like, he didn't try to put any of his bastards, because, like, Westeros does not give a fuck about high lords and ladies stepping out on each other. It's kind of considered a thing you can do, you know. But what they do not like, you know, because, you know, Ned Stark's got what everyone thinks is a bastard in his own fucking house at his court. Right. So it's not a secret. But what would ruffle a lot of feathers is Ned legitimizing Jon Snow and putting him in line for Winterfell. Because, again, Westeros just hates bastards. Mm-hmm. It's not about like, oh, well, they're Rhaenyra's bastards. So they still got the vote. It's just they're bastards. They are inherently abominations, sinful, and hearts filled with deceit. That's bullshit. I mean, it's like, obviously. You know.
Obviously, yeah.
We quite like a lot of the bastards on Game of Thrones, right? Like Gendry, like Jon Snow, who's actually secretly not a bastard. But yeah, I don't think this solves the problem, because, again, and if the king proclaiming him as his true heirs is interesting, because if I'm reading between the lines, you're saying that that's effectively legitimizing these bastards. But I guess the wrinkle there is Rhaenyra's not being honest. She's saying, no, 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 these aren't bastards. These are my true-born sons. Mm-hmm. And Viserys is like, are you deaf? Can you not hear my daughter? These are my true-born. He's not saying like, oh, yeah, Rhaenyra told me they're bastards, but I'm overlooking that. They're my true-born grandsires and heirs. Right?
Yeah. So if the information came out, I mean, it's already out there. People already know, obviously. But if it were ever to be like proven somehow that these are bastards, then the issue would come up anew, right? I would think.
You would think. But like, you know, now that I'm trying to think, like, what kind of evidence that you could, you know, like what kind of proof you could put forth that would prove the point at this point?
I can't imagine anything.
But yeah, the whole idea is like there's so many Westeros, like any place has a lot of rules and customs and superstitions, and you can't just look at one set, you know, in isolation, because, you know, if you go by just the laws, you're going to miss things. If you go by just the traditions, you're going to miss things. If you go by the fact that the king can do whatever he wants because he's the king or she's the queen, you're going to miss a lot, because there is a lot of restrictions on what they can do, both by law and also just in practice. You know, the king could order every lord to slit their firstborn's throats. But what would happen is damn near the whole realm would reunite their banners against him and overthrow him. So
And the people are a concern, you know. They don't often get mentioned. It's more about the lords and what they think. But the peasantry, look at what Masseria says, right?
Sure.
In this episode, something to Otto about, like, the people make you king, or people, like...
Yeah.
You have to get our permission, essentially, to do the things you want to do. And most of the time, the people don't really care, because it doesn't affect them directly, but...
I mean, there's several hundred thousand people that live in King's Landing. Mm-hmm. If they are starving, guess what? There's not enough gold cloaks, probably not even enough dragons in the kingdom to keep. I mean, they might not prevail, but King's Landing might be pulled down brick by brick, set to blaze. Like, you know, if you're dying, your whole family's dying, you got nothing to lose. So that's the thing. There's two safety valves. The king can do whatever they want, sure, but they can't piss off all the important lords, because that's who actually has the military might of the Seven Kingdoms. The king has very few forces that he can directly command. He calls banners. Mm-hmm. And if those banners don't answer or rise up against him, he's fucked. Second is the small folk. They're always outnumber the important people, and they don't usually care about the great games. Like, you know, they just want to be well-fed and have some entertainment and live out their lives. But if that stops happening, if they don't get their three squares... They don't have a roof over their head. There's disease running rampant because of some, you know, mismanagement or bullshit. They have a way of being letting themselves be heard as well. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. And now, back to Hot D. Let's move on to Jimmy. He says, I'm a bit behind. I just finished episode 5 where Daemon kills his wife, Lady Royce. This and the ongoing controversy between Rhaenyra and the king regarding her marriage got me wondering, how did Daemon end up with Lady Royce to begin with? He's a Targaryen prince and was presumably heir to the throne at the time of their clearly arranged marriage. Shouldn't his station have commanded more than a marriage to a lesser house? House Royce is in the Vale of Arryn, and I'm assuming a subject of House Arryn. Was there a major political gain in the marriage? So this is all stuff from the Fire and Blood books, but at the time of him being married, Daemon was third in line for the throne. behind his father and his older brother, Viserys. And that's before anyone starts having children.
Yeah, yeah.
So there would have to be catastrophic things to go wrong before he would be, you know, kind of like in the hot seat. And some of those catastrophic things did go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But like the but at the time of him being married, he was like, you know, not even a second son. He's like a third, you know, banana type of deal. Everyone's going to presume that Viserys is going to have kids and all that stuff. Also, Lady Rhea, the Royces are like the second most powerful house of the Vale. And the Vale is extremely powerful. At the time of Fire and Blood, they say they have a an army to rival the North, who's, I guess, got the largest, most well-equipped army at the time. Wow. So that you've already got the Vale kind of like in bed with Targaryens because Aemma, Viserys's queen, was from the Vale. So this is strengthening this important military tie. It got Daemon way the hell away from King's Landing, which was another objective. And also, this was a match architected by Daemon's grandmother, Alysanne. You know, Jaehaerys's queen, she of the Valyrian Steel Womb. And in general, what Queen Alysanne wants, she gets, you know, until Jaehaerys pisses her off and she goes away for a couple years. But anyway, hope that answers your question. Patty, with a link to a Hollywood Reporter interview with director of episode 8, Greta Patel, where she confirms that Alicent gave Diana a moon tea rather than poison. So an interviewer says at the start of the episode, there's a scene with Diana who is then noted as missing. Is she just recovering or transferred to another part of the Red Keep? Are we supposed to assume something happened to her where she didn't return? The director says, I think we're all waiting for an answer on that. I know Ryan Condal and Miguel Sapochnik were talking about Alicent paying her off and that she would disappear. The interviewer comes back and says, but the tea was really just to prevent pregnancy and Alicent was being sincere. She didn't secretly like have her killed or something. And the director says, oh, the tea was definitely to prevent pregnancy. The same tea that young Rhaenyra got. But after that, I'm curious where we go with that character. Does she ever come up again?
I read this interview. I think that's delightfully vague.
I thought so, too. Like, in fact, I was about to be like, why are you sending me this bullshit until we get to the final scene where she says, oh, the tea. Because when she says, oh, the tea's definitely to prevent pregnancy. Death prevents pregnancy.
It does. It does.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it terminates that whole deal. But it just in general. So like this is like this is something that's peculiar to, I think, Bald Move. And maybe it's because we've done this for so long. But I have been burnt so many times by breathlessly reporting something an actor, a director, or a showrunner says, and then it turns out to be bullshit. So while the director, while the title of director is a powerful one, His Majesty King Jaehaerys does not grant her the power to override his eyes and ears. And I think it's left deliberately ambiguous. So I don't understand why the director would come and clear up that ambiguity that they carefully constructed. But like I said, if you want to be Team Green and be like, Alicent would never do something like that, that's fine. That's fine. The canon, I think, weakly supports you. And if you want to be on Team Black and be like, yeah, fuck Alicent, she had an innocent handmaid killed, I think that's my bias. So yeah, I'd roll with that.
It's definitely not my reason for being on Team Black, but I feel like it's a Schrodinger's Diana here. Like, we'll know when we know or we won't, right? We'll either never open that box and find out, or we'll eventually see Diana again, and then we'll know it was just moon tea.
Yeah,
it's not, but right now I'm thinking it's moon tea for two, which is what I'm calling poison.
It's not super, and like I said, it's not super important to the show or whatnot, but this is one of the more frequent emails I got this week, so I want to make sure I got it up top.
Right.
Tom says, after the quote-unquote dinner party where Rhaenyra says to Alicent she's going back to Dragonstone, and Alicent says something to the effect of, so soon you just got here, and Rhaenyra replies, let me get my children home, I'll return on Dragonback. I can't help but think that comment of returning on Dragonback was an unknown at the time portent of things to come. Do you think this is tipped in the hand?
Really?
About what Team Black will do on... I'm coming back on Dragonback.
It could be cute foreshadowing given the events that transpire after. I can see that. The writer is throwing that in knowing, the next time we see Rhaenyra, she's not going to be happy. And she will be on her dragon.
All right. Of course, I find it all mildly interesting. Moving on to Lily, it says, hey, I just finished to the in- or I just listened to the instant take, rather, where you guys were debating the meaning behind Rhaenys, almost pronounce it wrong, Rhaenys busting through the boards on her beast. I'd also love to debate her intent, but that was basically ruined for me when Ryan Condal remarked that they basically just needed a big scene for a penultimate episode in the after show commentary. I was very much taken aback by that statement. Are they just doing stuff to do it because it looks cool without thinking about what it all means? Was it meaningless? Why not kill, or why kill innocent bystanders who were cheering for Aegon if she supports the Greens, but why not Dracarys them right then and there if she supports the Blacks? Honestly, I'm getting triggered from my season 8 Game of Thrones PTSD. PTSD? Yeah.
Yeah,
what do you think about that?
This is a lot of... It's a lot of controversy around this scene right now, from what I've seen on the internet. I think one of the writers, Sarah Hess, is getting a lot of shit for her comments right now, and I think not undeservedly so. She said essentially what Condal said there in that interview, that like, yeah, we needed something cool, we wanted something exciting to happen, and so we threw in that dragon scene. I don't know if that's really the reason you did it, just because we wanted something big and cool to happen. You've got to think through the ramifications of throwing something big and cool in there. And I'm certainly not of the opinion that it was like great. I don't agree with like the reasoning behind like how would Rhaenys act here, but I've seen several justifications for it, and one of those comes from Ryan Condal. I think it was Ryan Condal, or it might have been Hess, who said in that post episode interview that like she couldn't kill a mother in that moment who was protecting her son. And I'm like, man, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. It's if of all the mothers, this might be the mother you need to kill.
So I got a couple defenses of Rhaenys' decision here with her dragon. But before that, I also wanted to point out that like it's not inherently bad for showrunners to try to find like cliffhangers and triumphant notes to end episodes on. Uh-huh. Like that's called just good pacing. So like I don't like if just those words alone do not raise my alarm bells. So I think that's something that showrunners should be honestly working towards, you know, making the shows more exciting, more approachable, more evenly paced. But I did have a problem with, because it does seem like this solves all of the realm's problems. Now let's consider some defenses of this to see if we feel differently. All right. First up is Dan from Connecticut.
Well, hold on. I want to say one other thing too.
Sure.
As a podcaster, this is very much something that I feel strongly. A lot of the times I don't want to dig too deep and too minutely into what people say in interviews, because interviews are on the spot sort of things. And when you are trying to speak off the cuff about something, and then the internet gets a chance to dissect every single syllable of everything you said and piece together different interviews when you were in different state of minds, when you had different perspectives on things, that can be a dangerous combination for anybody's words. And I think you have to kind of give them a little bit of benefit of the doubt here. And people are not inclined to do that because they're upset about a decision they made or whatever. But I think like when someone is speaking off the cuff, it's really brutal to take that and dissect it piece by piece later after the fact.
Especially when talking about directors who might not have the full script for every season that they're going off of, who probably directed this 18 to 12 months ago.
That too, you know? Yeah.
And I mean, like, these are writers. Shit, I directed 7 shows since then. What? Yeah. Yeah. Writers and showrunners are a little bit, because they should have a good handle of the total
you
story.
But
directors, when directors make statements about like stuff, like I very much discount that, unless they're like a Sapochnik who also is an executive producer kind of showrunner too.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Now the defenses. Sorry.
Dan in Connecticut says, I thought placing the Red Queen Melis and the Queen that never was, Rhaenys, in a position to decapitate the Green regime was the first significant deviation from the book that was also a narrative misstep. In other words, an entirely unforced error. It didn't ruin the episode for me, but I was definitely having trouble understanding the purpose of the scene. But this morning, I remembered the canonical aversion to kinslaying depicted in both the written and TV Game of Thrones works. Perhaps this decision will create some tension and inquisition between Rhaenys and Rhaenyra. Regardless, I think the show is right to step lightly instead of lampshading Rhaenys' motives. In Martin's world, no man is as cursed as the Kingslayer. Well, see, that's why where she pulls off her awesome armor, revealing what's no doubt a glorious set of teats, and says, "I am no man."
Okay.
Anyway, unless I'm mistaken, Dracarys doesn't solve the dispute because I didn't notice Aegon's heirs on the dais. But neutralizing three green dragon riders would probably end any immediate threat to Rhaenyra's ascent on the Iron Throne. So, yes, if we're correctly interpreting this show, you always have to keep in mind what people sincerely believe. You know, I don't believe in the curse of kinslaying, although there's not any of my kin that I immediately want to kill. but it is a real thing. This is one of, like, this guest right bastard, we're talking about the highest taboos of the realm. And it's not that they're never broken. Mm-hmm. You know, Walder Frey did all, essentially, those things. Probably even fathered bastards. But they don't get broken lightly. Do you think here is... essentially, all of her family saved the Hightowers, who are not related to her by blood, but, you know, all of these kids are. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would give her pause?
I suppose. I'm torn on this. Like, I'm weighing, like, I'm trying to step out of the context that I have for this thing and step into Rhaenys's context, because surely she knows, like, there is going to be strife going forward, right? I'm not sure if she can understand in this moment that this might be the beginning of the fall of the Targaryen dynasty. Like, that's the thing. I know where this eventually leads because I've seen Game of Thrones. And yeah. I'm saying, yes, you absolutely should have done this. This is the moral decision, right? This is going back and killing baby Hitler.
With the benefit of hindsight, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But do you kill baby Hitler if you're standing in front of a goo goo gaga baby
at in some hospital?
Fuck, I don't know. 1887. I have no idea how old he was, but, like, you know what I mean? It's can you? And weighing that against kinslaying, weighing that against killing, you know, a mother or trying to protect her child, like,
right,
all of that is in there. So I'm trying not to get, like, too crazy about, oh, she should have just blasted him, just Dracarys him. Come on, it's the obvious move. It's not that obvious. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the moment. Josh kind of, like, you served him up a bit of dry pie, but, you know, he says, this would not, quote-unquote, end the war, because from Rhaenys' perspective, there is no war. As viewers, we know about the show is all about the Dance of Dragons and a civil war coming, but why should she? A wise older woman who has been through a lot, she can see this Aegon farce and assume the Greens will be brought to heel when the Black Army assembles with the most money, the biggest fleets, and the most dragons with enough loyal lords to negotiate a peaceful surrender from the Hightowers. In this episode, Allison has the same view of being able to negotiate a peace without bloodshed, so I imagine Rhaenys would do the same. So far, there's not been any major battles or deaths, so there's not enough bad blood between the families to justify burning all the Greens alive like that. I feel like these two have definitely cooled my heat towards, oh, she should have just Dracarys the shit out of him.
Yeah, I agree. I do think they do an interesting thing in that episode, which is they show Rhaenys seeing Lord Caswell hanged. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, should give her a clue that this is bigger than just, like, oh, they'll sort it out. You know? Yeah. Like, yeah. The lords are being hanged, which implies that, like, lords have had a question put to them about their loyalty.
Right.
And that implies something bigger coming, but only a little bit. It's not like, I don't know. Like I said, she doesn't have foresight in this situation, so I don't blame her too much.
Dave T says, which is more powerful right now in the hot D-verse, the hand of the king or the foot of the queen? I got so many variations of this sent to me this week, and across all social platforms, medias, meme image formats, everything. So I have to acknowledge it. And then everyone take a little bite of ginger for a palate cleanser, and let's move on to Frank T. Eric slash Arik says this to Aegon when they find him in his sept. Based on this, I'm pretty sure Otto wanted to find Aegon first. Oh, sorry. I copied out the subject line, which is Otto saying that he wants to meet him outside of King's Landing, outside the walls.
Yeah.
They say this to Aegon when they find him in the sept. Based on this, I'm pretty sure Otto wanted to find Aegon first because he knew Aegon was the wrong horse to bet on as the king moving forward. My guess is Otto was going to take Aegon outside the city and tell him he could leave as he wanted to in favor of Aemond as the new king. To me, this better explains the different groups racing to grab Aegon, as Alicent really believes what she thinks she heard from Viserys, that Aegon as king is necessary. Do you think Otto was trying to do a switcheroo? Or perhaps other people had the more strong version of this, which is Otto was just going to slit his throat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, immediately what I assumed. Maybe I'm not giving Otto enough credit. But that's an interesting idea that I hadn't considered. And it kind of makes a lot of sense. I'm sure he's noticed Aegon's behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So,
and he's got to be seeing that Aemond is the true steel.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting.
Yeah, that could be true.
I think it works on the face of it. Otto just wants to get, because a lot of people were saying that, because in the book, as I mentioned on the main podcast, this Council of the Greens takes place over the course of days while the king is rotting in his chambers. You know, they're trying to get solidify their power. And some people posited that like Otto trying to get the Aegon first represents more of a book version of the events, where Otto is like, you know what? Let's clam up. Let's grab everybody. I want to eliminate all the blacks before they even know what's happening. And then we put the king on the throne, where Alicent was the opposite. Let's put the king on the throne immediately. Let's get him on the Iron Throne. Let's get him the Blackfyre Blade. Let's get him the Aegon's crown. Let's put him in King's Landing, declare him king, and then it'll be, you know, it'll be a victory by fiat, and there's nothing the blacks can do about it. So I like that theory, that it's not so much he wanted to kill Aegon, but he wanted to keep all this under wraps until they 100% had a stranglehold on the power.
Yeah, that makes sense. Also,
Dana asks, why are the gold cloaks trying to close the door to the dragon pit where Rhaenys and Maelys had come up through the boards? They distinctly called attention to with Otto screaming, open the doors! Is this evidence that the gold cloaks are loyal to Daemon? Or did they just want to keep the dragon from escaping?
It's a good question. We didn't ever see them deal with the two loyal Daemon loyalists, right?
Yeah.
In the gold cloaks. Not that I think that's what's happening here necessarily, but I was a little confused by that too. I don't have a great explanation for open the doors, because the people are trying to rush out. They're trying to close them. Otto wants them open.
Yeah.
Why does he want them open? Also,
to me, the look on his face is like, holy shit, do not, you know, don't corner this woman on her dragon. Like, make sure the doors are open so that she can peacefully go if she wants to.
Well, that's saying the woman who just busted through the floor on her dragon is going to be cornered by shutting a door. That's a little
more
silly.
More cornered than not.
I
think Otto
cornered.
Otto number one does not want to see potentially tens of thousands of people die. The gold cloaks, I think, are probably reacting to the fact that there's a loose dragon and like, holy shit, close the doors to make sure the dragon doesn't get out. And Otto is like, no, fuck
that.
Which
is also silly.
Open the doors, you know. It is weird, because I meant to comment on that, but I didn't, because it's strange. It's strange.
Surely he didn't think he was going to get out those doors, right? He's not going to run off the dais and
think he's just trying to think of anything that, because like, they have nothing. They have no answer. They have no dragon. That's what it would take. You'd have to have a bigger dragon. And even then, good God, do you want to be caught in the middle of like Vhagar battling melees in the middle of the dragon pit while you're sitting right there? Like they're fucked. So he's just thinking like, well, I don't know. Maybe we open the doors, she'll just leave. It's weak.
It's like when a fly gets in your car, right? Or a wasp gets in your car.
Yeah, you roll down the window. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. You're not locked in here with me. I'm not locked in here with you. Just peacefully go, man. Susan W. says, there's no way that dragon cleanly fits through those doors of the... Well, she says the sept, but she's talking about the dragon pit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, canonically, these bronze doors are supposed to be big enough for 30 fully armed knights on horseback to fit through riding abreast.
Whoa.
And they kind of appear that big, and also, canonically, these doors are big enough to house both Balerion and Vhagar. So okay. It might be, and you know, we kind of joked about this with the Rings of Power, because there's a couple of scenes where they're going in and out of this island of Numenor, and I swear to God, there's a bridge that none of these ships should fit under or through.
Mm-hmm. Well, they dismantled the bridge and moved it. Yeah,
that's true. That's true. They did the Jeff Bezos special. Mm-hmm. I think, like I said, I think that the showrunners thought that they made doors big enough for the dragon to fit through. Canonically, they are, and maybe it's a trick of perspective or whatever, but yeah, I'm gonna give it to them.
I like in that moment when the dragon flies through the doors, they don't do it like the dragon is just kind of gliding, because how could it glide when it pulls its wings in? It kind of like takes a dip down toward the ground when it does that, and then has to regain its altitude. I really like the effect there.
Couldn't fly through, but it can kind of, like I said, it kind of jumped. It went from the floor because there's like those steps up and kind of just went through a parabolic arc, tucked its wings and legs. And you can imagine like something like Balerion, you know, kind of like, you know, making it, maybe tucking his wings and kind of like ducking under it or something like that. Kinsey has another question about the dragon pit. At the end of episode 9, everyone meets on the inside of the dragon pit where dragons are supposedly kept in the keep underneath it. How the hell did Meleys break through the floor? Isn't this place supposed to house the dragons and keep them locked away? Wouldn't this place be built to be a bit more dragon-proof? What are your thoughts on this?
I'm curious what the purpose of the dragon pits is. Is it a dungeon for dragons? Because that's not my... That wasn't my feeling on it. My feeling was more like it's a hotel for dragons or a...
What is this? Some kind of dungeon for dragons?
It's like a dragon hostel. Like they're all hanging out down there just sleeping in a dragon den, really. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah. No, you're... So
I feel like it's more voluntary.
Coincidentally, I did a little bit more reading on the dragon pit myself because I was kind of interested in some of these details. And apparently, I think it was Magor... was kind of freaked out that Balerion was kind of allowed some of the larger dragons, just kind of like when they were riderless, were just allowed to do whatever the fuck they wanted. Sometimes they roosted a dragon stone. Sometimes they fucked off to Essos for a bit. And he was persuaded to, like, you know, maybe we should have a little bit more security around these things. So they designed the dragon pit to very closely approximate the natural habitat of the dragon on Dragonstones. Like, they mentioned that they have these like concentric rings of tunnels that go far underneath the hill, which, funny enough, is called Rhaenys's Hill. The three hills that of King's Landing all are named after Aegon, Visenya, and Rhaenys. The dragon pit happens to be on Rhaenys's Hill. But this is like this kind of warren of catacombs going into the hillside, and they're all like approximating the structure of where the dragons roost on Dragonstone, only larger to presumably be more comfortable for the dragons. But then they also have like, you know, the double doors, so they can't, you know, there's like a, you know, each roost has like two doors you can open, like, you know, be kind of like a dragon airlock, I guess. So yeah, it was designed to keep, you know, because to move the dragons from essentially Dragonstone as their primary roost to the seat of the power of the Targaryens, to provide security for them, because that's at that point is when they got 77 knights and they made them into the dragon keepers. I think they're supposed to be the guys we see in robes in the books. They wear this like cool black armor, and they're like the honor guard for the dragons. And they started taking more, like, you know, the care and keeping of the dragons a little bit more seriously. So now that's the thing. So dragons normally don't want to destroy their home. Like, I'm sure dragons could bust through the cliff walls of Dragonstone anytime they wanted to, if they were aroused through wrath or through, you know, their rider spurring them on. I just don't know what human structure could conceivably keep a dragon against its will.
Yeah.
You know, it's more of like the dragons kind of want to be in the dragon pit because that's where they're fed and it's comfortable for them. But if they were like starved or something, they would probably bust out. Or if they were enraged, they'd probably bust out. So I guess I didn't have a problem. Do you have a problem with Rhaenys surviving the process of Melee's Kool-Aid manning through the floor of the dragon pit?
Yeah, every time I think about it, I'm like, well, okay, maybe the dragon came up like wings covering her and like protected her intentionally. Because it's the only way that that happens.
Or use its tail to like batter a hole and then crawl through it. That's another way you don't have. Because like I think a lot of people just be like the literally Kool-Aid mans, like back,
yeah,
right, like saddle up first, uh-huh, bust through the stone wall, and you know, like I get you're wearing some armor, but is it dragon pit cave-in proof? I don't know. Let's move on to Allison, who says, "Could Rhaenys have suggested to Allison that she should rule simply to destabilize the Hightowers? Just whisper into her ear. Have you ever thought about sitting on the Iron Throne? It creates a head game, putting a wedge that can only grow in Allison's mind towards all the men she's surrounded by, which is several, including the new king and Otto, and maybe weakens her laser focus on her son's rise to power. It's brilliant if so, because she does so while maintaining neutrality and perhaps even forging a bond with the queen. In an episode where Allison recognizes the manipulation of her father, how much credit do we give to Rhaenys?"
It's a good question.
I like this take, yeah.
Not 100% certain about Rhaenys' motivations here. There was a time when she professed to not want power. She's gotten over it, right? She's no longer the potential queen. She got passed over for that. She was bitter for a while, but now she's fine with it. And don't rock the boat. And then Corlys went off on his 6-year voyage.
Right.
And she sat on the throne at high tide or Driftmark, uh-huh, wherever. And then that seemed to change. She wanted to advocate for herself to continuously rule there. She's now telling Allison, hey, have you ever thought about being on the throne yourself? She's always had that view, that anger against like, hey, why can't women rule? But she seemed a lot more resigned to it at the beginning of this series, and something changed. And I really think it's getting the taste, getting the feel for it when Corlys left Driftmark.
It could be. It also could be that, like, when she was telling Corlys, like, would you stop this? Like, it was almost always in context of you're putting our kids in danger. Like, once the last child died, I wonder, and as you say, she got to sit on, you know, she got the lead Driftmark for some period of time. I wonder if, so there's two ways to look at it. Number one, she's got the taste for power. She saw the way Viserys stood up for the family, the way Rhaenyra is ready to fight for the family, and she's got like that Targaryen stirrings within her, like, fuck yeah, this is fucking fire and blood, baby. I love it. But also, like, she just doesn't want to be fucked with, and the best way to ensure she doesn't get fucked with is to rule her own house, you know, because then the only one that can fuck with her is the king or queen.
Yeah.
But everybody else, there's no way. She got the most powerful navy. She got a couple dragons she can command. She's essentially a power unto herself, and I think that's very attractive for someone like Rhaenys, who feels like she's been jerked around like her entire life.
Yeah, and I go into all that to say I'm not totally certain of her motivations in this scene. She seems like somebody who believes what she's saying to Allison, that, like, you know, women should have a right to rule just as much as men. And so I don't think that this is her just trying to, like, split the party here. But maybe. Maybe there's a tinge of that in there, too. She knows that, like, I can both be true to myself and potentially disrupt the people who are very swiftly becoming my enemies.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know if it's intentional, but like it does seem like it got the wheel spinning in Allison's head. Donna says, I heard in another podcast a simple way to distinguish between the two twins. She credits Josh Wiggler and friends in their podcast. Says, Jim will like this one. Eric, mm-hmm, with an A, is the a-hole who stays leal to Aegon the asshole, while Eric is the one who helps Princess Rhaenys escape.
The first part is better than the second
half.
A
for
that,
the asshole Aegon. E for helping the princess escape. All right. So there we go. See if we can remember these mnemonic
devices.
What's
easier? Black Knight, Green Knight. Much easier.
That doesn't help you with the name. Oh, that's right. You just don't care what their names are.
Yeah, just don't
are.
Give a gotcha. Shit what their names are. Yeah.
Well, with identical twins, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, kinda, I could lose a hot dog eating competition to him.
All right. The beast beneath the board's truthers want to be heard. The wake up, sheeple. You think that the beast was melees and the boards were those stone floor of the dragon pit? Fuck out of here. Brian from Rockland, New York says the beast beneath the boards is not a rampaging dragon that does not kill anyone of importance. You hear that, small folk? I think it has to do with the rats, and the beast is going to be the plague, something like the Black Death that would really fuck up King's Landing. Consider that the small folk herded in for the coronation did not give a shit about Aegon, but once he flashed his sweet, sweet sword, they exploded in applause. The small folk are not quick to riot. They'd see $4 gas and 10% inflation as just part of life. But they start dying off from disease, the royals are going to have a real problem. We think the beast might be... There's been a lot of emphasis on rats. You know, rats known as a carrier of plague and contagion. What do you think about this plague-based beast theory?
I mean, it's possible. I haven't seen any hint of it yet, which is strange given what Viserys has been through. It strikes me as weird that Viserys was in such close proximity to everyone. I mean, his disease must not be contagious. Just period.
Yeah, must not be.
Yeah.
Must not be.
But I don't know. Maybe that's foreshadowing for something that's going to rot the people as well.
Could
be. Since he was Viserys the Peaceful. I don't know.
Ryan W. says, could the beast beneath the boards mean Aegon? After all, he was discovered underneath a table in the Sept.
Was discovered underneath a table in the Sept. Oh, that's a table? I thought that was like an altar.
It looks stone, but if we're calling the four the dragon pit boards, then fuck it.
I mean, sure, yeah. I mean, beast beneath the boards. He's certainly more of a beast than I realized before last episode.
What about this one? Daniel J says, I posted this on Reddit to see if anyone else had picked up on it, and I seem to be the only one. Could the beast beneath the boards be Aegon's little bastard kid? We meet him this week, and he's conspicuously introduced to us hiding beneath literal floorboards. He included a picture of this poor kid with, like, you know, the vertical lines of these joists
the
over him.
Coming through the rays, yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, so if there's another time jump, I'm going to be looking for people with sharpened teeth. Just saying.
You look like you came from Fleabottom, Lord Beast. No, why would you say that? These are congenitally
Lord
pointy teeth.
Beast.
I have a condition, okay? Mildly interesting. Like,
yeah,
I said, I'm still like, I don't have any reason to think this. It's just that the show keeps, like, you know, whenever Helena is saying, oh my God, the beast, and then immediately Aemond walks in and the camera pan. I take a lot of stock in that. So
yeah.
Mildly interesting to be sure. But that's, I thought those are three solid competing beast theories if you want to eliminate the Red Queen from contention.
There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, as a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, back to Hot D.
All right. It's the part of the podcast where we convene the Council of the Blacks and the Greens. The Greens went first last week, so keeping it leal, we're going to start with the Blacks this time. Brian says, I fundamentally disagree with the assessment that show is putting the thumb on the scales for the Blacks over the Greens. I have a few unspoilery notes on my reading of the source material and how I feel a number of changes are sympathetic to the Greens. So this is interesting. This guy is saying, like, put aside the show. Let's see what the books had to say about these things and how the show has chosen its art narrative to favor one side or the other. So, like, you got two layers of favoritism, how you adapt the source material, and then, you know, whatever you add on top of that. So, first of all, he says, I came away from reading Fire and Blood definitely favoring and truly only understanding the perspective of Team Black. Partially because Alicent in the book gives off major wicked stepmother vibes. There's a heightened concentration on her physical attractiveness, which for me recalls Snow White or Cinderella and the venial stepmothers of those stories. On the show, Alicent is, in her youth, shown to be modest, kind, and smart. With my reading, they could have certainly given her a villainous sexpot feel that would have read true. Secondly, and textually, Viserys is a pretty uninteresting character with shallow tendencies. He loves feast and tournaments, essentially. My read of the overall relationship with Alicent was that she was a vapid but pretty accessory to this somewhat shallow dude. On story, the story on screen in Hot D showed Viserys and Alicent having intellectual connection and Alicent caring for him despite his being gross. Also, there are many mushroom rumors of sexual improprieties by Alicent as well as Rhaenyra that the show doesn't give even a whisper to, while all those about Rhaenyra are shown to be true to at least some degree. Interesting. Thirdly, maybe I'm a fool, but I didn't take from the text that the allegations of Rhaenyra's children being bastards was an absolute fact, but more speculation. It actually irritated me that Alicent and her children feel so certain about this based on hair color mostly. Canonically, Rhaenys, the queen that never was, is a dark-haired descendant of Baratheon stock, and we know from the main books how strong the seed is with Baratheons. Her grandchildren turning out dark-haired does not strain credulity at all. By making Rhaenys white-haired but Corlys brown-skinned, they not only proved their bastardry, but also made Rhaenyra an inveterate gaslighter. Fourthly, all the worst suspicions of Daemon are confirmed on the show. In the book, I never thought he killed Rhea Royce, even though it's mentioned as an option. It seems like he's not there, and I didn't give it much thought. Daemon also gets a poetic intro in the book as a peerless character in the history of the realm. Not only this story, we're basically outright told that he's a complicated guy with many charms. The show has the burden of having to show this with mixed results. Fifthly, it seems that everyone thinks that the laner change, his escaping rather than dying, heavily tips the scales. And I understand his perspective. After all, by current values, it does seem magnanimous to allow Laenor to live his life, and it relieves Rhaenyra of any blame. But this telling makes Rhaenyra intricate in the plan to remarry without her husband being dead, which I think is very shady. Sixth, lastly, the fight with the kids gave me much more empathy for Aemond, though I still think he's being an a-hole. In the text, it's the littlest child, Joffrey, that's mildly attacked by Aemond, and the girls weren't even there. On the show, the girls are there, and it's a 4-on-1 dogpile that he fights his way out of. Yes, Allison lifting the dagger and attacking was an addition in the favor of Team Black, but for me, it was kind of a wash. Then we get to this episode and just wow. They went with the mushroom child fighting thing, added some foot fetish stuff to boot, which just really makes the greens look terrible. But at the same time, instead of calling Rhaenyra a whore as she does in the book, Allison seems to genuinely mourn Viserys and is worried for Rhaenyra and her plain-featured children. Maybe they're trying to put the thumb on the scales, but I genuinely feel like the show has muddied things by wanting the audience to like Allison but hate her side in general. This follows the Tyrion Lannister mode of storytelling, because truthfully, Game of Thrones really softened Tyrion's hard edges, and it's nothing like the rehab Allison's getting here. I thought this was interesting, that from his perspective, we're already one layer removed of thumbs towards the green, because by fleshing out and humanizing the greens that is not done in the novel, they're inherently more sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, does that help the vast majority, the 99% of the fans that have not read the books and are just watching the show, though?
That's the thing, isn't it? It's you might get this extra layer of, well, they're doing things to moderate the greens here. And that might well be true. I don't feel that as somebody who has not read the book. So, and there are a lot of me's out there. I think you're dead on when you talk about like Alicent being kind of the exception within Team Green. I am feeling a lot of sympathy for Alicent, even though she's complicit in all the same schemes. She's just far more humane about everything. She's far more loving and kind about the way that this is all going to go down. And she's doing it for reasons that are more noble than the reasons Otto Hightower is doing this, right? Like, she's doing it because she thinks her children are in danger. He's doing it because he wants more power. So that's the thing. They are definitely doing things in the show that without that book knowledge, I feel are weighting it toward the blacks, being the more leal side here. But I am giving Allison a bit of a pass based on the last couple of episodes and knowing that she's feels very threatened right now.
Yeah, I think the comparison with Allison as the Tyrion of the group is very apt, because we all hate the Lannisters. Maybe we take a shine to Jaime later on, but initially we all fucking hate the Lannisters, but Tyrion was really cool because he's very sympathetic. He's in a bad spot with even within his own family, but he's trying to be loyal to it. He's a very complicated guy. Mm-hmm. I think Allison, that's a good analogy. Allison is the Tyrion of the Hightowers.
Yeah,
that you don't agree with her support of the family and maybe everything she does, but you kind of understand how and why she got there.
Yeah, she just needs to be a little more charming and a little funnier, and you have a direct comparison.
Guro's up next and says, I think it's obvious that the show wants us to root for Nira and her band of problematic faves, because that's just storytelling. One way they can make us root for Team Black and vilify Team Green is how they play on the practice versus preach dynamic. We see Team Green is playing it oh so righteous, but are doing a lot of shitty things. That's something that will annoy a viewer because it breaks with what they're preaching and the image that they're constructing. It does seem that viewers don't like hypocrisy.
Yeah, no one does, I don't think.
Team Black doesn't pretend to be fully good or fully right. The viewer therefore gets a higher tolerance for their level of mischief. I think this is why Aemond is setting out to be the new problematic fave on the green side. He's shit, he knows it, and he embraces it. Yeah, I like Aemond. He's my new problematic fave. Secondly,
is he shit? Let me ask you this. Is he shit? Because he's a kid who's been thrust into this situation, has no say in the matter whatsoever. I haven't seen him do anything that's too awful at this point.
Like, yeah.
Here's the thing. He made a really stupid, boneheaded move when he was a young kid, in that he was going to try and kill his cousin. That's probably, or nephew. I don't know. It's so confusing.
They're nephews.
He was going to try and kill his nephew. That's a bad mistake, kid. Older Aegon or older Aemond. I haven't seen him do anything yet that I'm really like, you should know better. He let Luke get the best of him with the pink dread thing. And, you know, he made a toast in poor taste, but I haven't really seen him being a super shit yet. I think that will come at some point, maybe not the next episode, but in season two, probably I'll stop rooting for Aemond. But so far, Aemond's A-okay in my book.
Yeah, no, it's funny because like if if Luke and Jake's had just not risen to his dog whistle, mm-hmm. if he'd be like, well, thank you, uncle, for recognizing our physical strength. We really appreciate that. Like, what, you know, what Aemon either has to explicitly right. call into question and stop hiding behind this elaborate clever, or he just, the matter drops.
And he was provoked. I think he was fine just sitting at that provoked. Table with these people and not making a stir, not making a fuss. But then they put this in front of him, start laughing in his face. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on. And
he's got the bit. Yeah. Yeah. Come on. Secondly, the whole Team Green argument on succession is just all over the place. First, they want to remove Rhaenyra as the heir because of gender, which is stupid, but fair considering the logic and rules of the fictional world. Then they don't want to acknowledge her as the heir because she's got illegitimate children, which you could argue is a fireable offense, but they don't make that argument. If the pure line is so important, the matter should have been changed or even solved when Rhaenyra and Daemon got three blonde penis-having children. You can figure out something for the strong boys. I heard Essos is cool. So what's the issue, Team Green? Let me call timeout on Team Black. What are you going to do with the children that Rhaenyra has previously claimed as trueborn and the king has affirmed as trueborn? What are you going to do? You're just going to send them?
Put them to the sword.
Under what pretext?
Right.
Like, you'd have to get Trixie. Like, oh, we're gonna send my three favorite children off to battle, and oh fuck, they died, or they're all gonna have a tragic dragon riding accident. Or no, I don't. The thing is, if Rhaenyra takes action against them directly and reveals that she's been lying, I just don't know how she politically recovers from that.
Well, doesn't that fuck up the whole thing? Like, if she,
what would she have to do? She'd be like,
yeah,
Harwin know. Strong used to come into my bedroom with brown face, wearing my husband's clothes, and I've always been nearsighted. That's how I'm Rhaenyra. I'm Rhaenyra sighted, and I just didn't even know this whole time. It was a folly perpetuated on me by the men.
Bamboozled. No, that's not gonna work.
No, I don't think. I don't think she could make that argument. But anyway, the lack of penis on Rhaenyra, or the fact that a strong boys is the wrong half of Targaryen. You could argue that a Targ egg plus womb is better than some Targ sperm. Yeah, again, if you put away the crazy prejudice against bastards, the crazy irrational prejudice against bastards, then you would have a different outcome. But that's like, you know, if you set crazy and irrational prejudice against women and minorities in this country, our political landscape would look a lot differently, you know? Like, if the world were different, things would not happen the same. Yes, this is true. This plays into the vilification of Team Green, where it's quite obvious that they just don't want a woman to be the head of state, and that they've told Rhaenyra as a woman to, or they hold Rhaenyra as a woman to higher standards than a male heir. We as viewers are watching with today's sensibilities, and we'll read the double standards as unfair and unreasonable. I do think that that's the fatal flaw of Team Green, that they're just depicted as hypocrites.
Yeah.
And the best you can say, well, this really only applies to Allison too, because Otto is just nakedly wielding power for its own sake. But like, it's just really hard for your average viewer with, as you say, modern sensibilities to see this holy rolling Allison, you know, foot modeling for Varys and perhaps, you know, doing some kind of weird sexual dynamic thing with Sir Criston Cole and having potentially handmaids murdered, going along with the execution or the assassination of a highborn family, whatever, you know, like she's preaching this righteousness and purity and all this stuff, but you know, she's compromising those ideals left, right, and center. And it's just, that's hard to get behind. Whereas Team Black, yeah, they do a bunch of shit, but they kind of own it, you know, more or less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nate says, in today's pod, you discuss Otto Hightower and his role in creating the very situation he tells Allison about to get her to oppose Rhaenyra. I've had the thought from the beginning of the season that this would be a great classroom study in case of international relations theory. IR theory is categorized into three basic schools. You got your realist and your neo-realist, which think that all states, kingdoms, empires, democracies, dictatorships, whatever, are in constant competition with each other, and given the opportunity, each state would conquer or dominate its neighbors. Alliances and friendships between different nations is not a natural thing, but occurs when states don't feel that they could conquer or dominate their neighbors because they would fail or be too costly, or when they need to make common cause with other smaller states to balance the power of a large state and prevent being conquered. This is a stereotypical dog-eat-dog world. The ends justified the means. Resources must be secured and hoarded. The only way to prevent war is to be strong enough to win any war. Then you have your liberals, neoliberals, which note this is the international relations theory definition, not the classical economics definition or how it's used colloquially here in the United States and abroad. Mm-hmm. So, like the neorealists, they think the nations of the world are in competition with one another, but we can create political and social structures to mitigate that competition and create a stable world order. International law, the United Nations, mutually beneficial treaties, etc., are all ways to help remove tension and competition between states or make it too costly to act outside the bounds of international norms. Then you have constructivists. All political alignments, including the nation state, are just constructs created by humans. So there's no inherent reason that we have to be in competition. There's no reason we have to be divided up in us versus them, and thus no reason everything has to be a war for control. Resources can be allocated to help those in need without it creating a threat to others. No, we can't just wish the world's problems away, but we can solve them a lot more easily if we work together instead of competing. Now, these are obviously archetypes, and full disclosure, I fall mostly into the constructivist category. But here's the thing. It doesn't matter what I, the United States, the United Nations, or all seven kingdoms decide to adopt as its international relations philosophy, a neorealist state will reject both the constructivist and neoliberal order. All efforts to deal with a neorealist state will be perceived as either a threat, trickery, or weakness, because a neorealist a priori assumption is that given the chance, your country will attack mine. It's paranoia, although to be fair, we would call constructivists unrealistic dreamers. Otto is a classic neorealist. In his mind, everything is a part of the competition over the throne. He assumes two givens. A, the misogynist lords of the realm won't support a female heir. And B, once Rhaenyra takes the throne, she'll have to eliminate Alicent's kids as alternatives to her line. Because if she doesn't, at some point the lords, who will not support the female heir, will just scheme to put Aegon or Aemond or any other one in Old Town on the throne. It's kill or be killed, and he passes that on to Alicent, the idea that the only way to ensure the safety of her and her children is to kill Rhaenyra. Except, like most neorealists, he assumes that this is the case because he cannot see any other paradigm but competition between factions. So there's more to this, but he comes back to, through a constructivist lens, there's no reason for all of this to lead to war, and Otto's paranoia and ambition have created the whole situation. The correct action, as we've mentioned, would have been to do the opposite. The Otto, Alicent, and their kids should have been the most vocal and visible supporters of Rhaenyra from the first moment she was named heir. What about the misogynistic lords that won't accept a female on the throne, you say? Well, they can't just overthrow the Targaryens, especially a united Targaryen family with all of their dragons. To rebel and put a male heir on the throne, they need a male heir stooge to do so. But if the Hand, the Queen, and the half-brothers of Rhaenyra are all aligned to support her, there's no one to support for anyone disgruntled about a woman ruler. If they stood all together, as Viserys stated in the earlier episodes, they'd have more than enough to handle any challenges from the Lords of the Realm. They've got 8 to 9 dragons. You don't even need the gold cloaks to burn the castles of every unleal misogynist in the realm. I thought this was pretty interesting, especially that line, the crucial line that, you know, a constructivist or a neoliberal can like see the other person's positions, but a neorealist can literally not conceive of the other person's worldview. In fact,
and they're framing everybody else's worldview within their own. Yeah.
In fact, any attempts to get you to see it from their point of view is going to be met with open hostility because you're just trying. You wouldn't want me to put down my sword first. Fuck that.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to get. Like, this email kind of like puts it in like formal theoretical categories that like Otto sincerely believes this is the way the world works, and he sees it as a foregone conclusion. Thus, the only rational act is to strike first.
Yeah, no, that absolutely describes him to a T. He is a neorealist or a realist. I don't know.
So Nate says all that to say that King Jim Harris is correct and this is all Otto's fault.
Oh, yeah. I think that's easy to see even if you don't have this category system.
All right. Let's move on to Team Green and see their response. Daniel says, I just want to note for the record that Rhaenys, a Targaryen, just indiscriminately murdered hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent citizens. I point this out because I'm waiting to watch the fan community express next to no outrage about this, while instead doubling down on their hatred of Greens. You're black. How do you respond?
What number of ants would you not kill to be released from prison if you thought you were about to be executed?
What, are we talking about my ants?
No, the animals. The
oh,
insects.
Ants. Okay, what, I thought you were talking about family members. I'm like, I don't know, man. I think I would probably not many. I wouldn't kill many of my ants to get out of prison. I just carry that weight.
No, what number of ants? What number of insects would you not kill to escape your own death? That's
you're right.
Yeah,
they're small folk. They don't matter.
Commoners, lowborn.
In aggregate, sure, but onesie, twosie, hundreds, thousands, not that big a deal. The other way I got is like, okay.
I say that. Look, let's say I don't believe that, right? I think the lowborn people, commoners, whatever, are just as important as the royals here. But
well, see, no, we don't have to say this shit because we're Americans. We abolished all these class and social distinctions. So we're all the same. We're all at the same level. We don't have...
obviously.
That's obviously
me and
delusional
Jeff Bezos,
fiction.
There's no difference.
Yeah. No, not at
me
all.
Me and Elon Musk as far as quality
of
life.
You both get one vote, Jim. What's the problem?
That's true. I can vote with all of my dollars in just the exact way that he can vote with all of his.
Yeah. The other thing is like, okay, let's construct a scenario in which a person's falsely imprisoned and they have an elaborate scheme to bust out, and they're going to make toilet nitroglycerin and they're going to form that into sticks, and they're going to put it against the wall of the cell, and they're going to blow it up. Unbeknownst to them, there's a school bus of children on the other side of that wall, and it gets blown to hell. Is the prisoner morally culpable for the death of those children?
Well, I don't know that we can claim that it's unbeknownst to Rhaenys that she's going to, that there are people across this floor. She just came.
Maybe
from
this
that
is the
crowd.
World's fastest coronation, and she thinks like by surely I've waited long
enough time.
Yeah, they've gotten out of here.
Did you see me struggle into this armor? It took at least 10 minutes. At least. I didn't have anybody helping me. It might have taken 3 hours.
She had to put on full fucking plate armor with no assistance, no squire. Yeah.
Nope.
That's actually kind of fucking amazing. I wonder if Bailey's helped her. I would love to see like these dainty little claws, you know, holding up the breastplate for her to shrug into. Like, you know, here you go, mom. Yeah, you're right. I think she heard the cheering. She did, and she didn't give a shit. But I was just saying, you know, she's trying to break free from unjust captivity here. Dapo from New Jersey. Is going to make a case for Otto. Here we go. We asked for it. Let's see if it works. Let's start at the beginning. The center of this show is a duty of the crown to maintain House Targaryen on the throne in order to avoid Aegon's dream. This is why Viserys went through multiple miscarriages with his beloved wife, because a woman was not a reliable heir. He knows that better than anyone else. It's the sole reason he is king, after all. Due to the guilt of killing his wife, he makes Rhaenyra the heir, not because it's the right thing to do, but guilt. Again, by no fault of her own, she is an unreliable heir. This is where Otto comes in. He knows she's unreliable. She wasn't plotting to kill Queen Aemma and replace her with Alicent, so I don't think he was driven by a search for power. What Otto did was recognize a problem created by the king's guilt and try to steer him to a solution. Remarry and try again. It is his duty, and also the realm, kind of depends on having a reliable heir, or else the long night comes. Otto may have taken slight liberty by putting his daughter into the mix, but Viserys wasn't forced to marry her. Some people are hung up on how Otto benefits from this arrangement, but forget that even without Otto in the picture, the king still needed a male heir. If Sir Strong was his hand at the time, he would have suggested the same. Marry a new wife and make more heirs. Having one heir and a female at that was too risky. So king, you know, Otto's just, he's just being leal for the realm, man. He's looking out. This is very similar to this is very related to the neo-realist theory, I think.
Oh, totally. Here's the thing. Where he's putting his thumb on the scale, right? Like we've talked about, he could have chosen the other path. Like I think of, I mean, this isn't the greatest of examples, but I think of Senator slash Emperor Palpatine from the Star Wars prequels.
All right.
And I think about his line, I will make it legal. Why can he not make her reliable? Why can he not start changing the perspective of the people to match what the king wishes, what the king believes has to happen, and what is morally right, in my opinion?
The other thing is, I think that this would be a more plausible theory of Otto's just trying to do what's right than, you know, in the third episode, I think, The Hunt, where you see his brother being like, why aren't you trying harder to get this boy, our boy, on the throne, you know? Mm-hmm. And like Otto's thinking like, dude, I have pushed so hard, his brother. So like, I think you're supposed to understand behind the scenes, this has been something that they've talked about. And that seems like almost an open conspiracy to at least, you know, subvert the king's will. You know, maybe you could argue it's best for the realm to avoid civil war and all that stuff. But like, it's certainly treasonous the way he's doing it.
Yeah, I would say.
It's interesting, though. I was thinking about this, about to avoid. So, like, if we go to shows, like, you have to have a Targaryen to unite the realm. It's interesting that when the Robert's Rebellion happens, it seems like that closely coincides with the White Walker stirring up north. Like, maybe Aegon, maybe this would have happened 300 years ago, but Aegon saw it in his vision and caught it in time and got the Targaryens and, you know, like... And then I was like, okay, if that's the case, like, what does a White Walker consider a Targaryen on the throne? Do they have to have the last name Targaryen? Do they have to have one drop of Targaryen blood? Do they have to have at least half Targaryen blood?
Yeah.
Do they have to have ride dragons? Like, that's, I've always wondered when you say there always has to be a Stark in Winterfell. What the fuck does that even mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how diluted could you get a Stark bloodline through intermarriage and stuff before it's like, there's no longer a Stark in Winterfell? Not really. Not by the way the old gods are keeping score.
Yeah.
Anyway, Nick says, I couldn't help but think about Allison's out of the blue line in episode 7, Driftmark, where she snaps and attacks Rhaenyra with the cat's paw dagger. Where is the duty? Where is the sacrifice? Trampled under your pretty foot again. In light of the wild foot scene with Larys from this episode, I couldn't help but feel that part of Allison's breakdown in the scene is caused by the fact that she's being sexually exploited by Larry. Beginning of this episode, let's not forget that creepy Larry's grin he's giving to Allison. Remember, we're talking about, like, why is he leering at the queen this way?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me on reflection, this grinning is kind of a poise-coital glow. Step back to the first time these two meet for dinner after the time jump, and Allison actually takes off her shoes before sitting down for dinner.
Oh, you're right.
This exploitation has likely been happening since she was a child. That's kind of tracks. Like, it makes sense. Larys's
special rose or whatever.
Yeah, and him just like leering at her at the party, and you know that, like, maybe this has been going on for a long time.
I hadn't considered that.
They say this development adds so much more sympathetic depth to the show version of Allison. While Rhaenyra couples for love and passion, Allison's sexual encounters are either for duty, i.e. being pimped out by her father and having a decaying old man pump away on top of her. Full body shudder on that one. Or, in this case, sacrifice. Allison is forced to sacrifice her dignity and keep the foot jobs coming to keep her children safe from the Game of Thrones. Okay. Yeah, no, I think this is not bad headcanon. And
this does nothing for Team Green, though. This does nothing to favor Team Green, because as much as it sympathizes Allison, it makes Larys more the monster. Correct? And he is on Team Green.
He's on Team Green.
It's a wash.
But Allison's on the top of the Greens, you know, and it's like, you got to have your leader above reproach, right? I don't know.
It seems like that's ideally
Team Green,
sure.
But you're right. You just turned it on me.
Larys is technically Team Green right now. I don't know if that'll remain true.
That's the interesting question. Is Larys Team Green?
Oh, especially if Rhaenyra does have the prettiest feet.
She wins the prettiest feet in the realm competition.
Uh-huh. Larys might switch sides.
Do you even think that the prettiness of the foot is, or is it the power and the discomfort that the queen is like...
Oh, you think really he gets off there. On making her squirm?
I think so. At least it does. If not, it just doesn't bother him, which is like almost as bad, you know?
Yeah. No, that's why the only thing that really like sympathizes Team Green for me at all is when Alicent shows some kindness, some genuine affection for Rhaenyra. Because that's like, yeah, you can say, oh, Alicent, poor Alicent, she's been used and abused her whole life. And I agree. But she's been used and abused by other members of Team Green, and that does nothing for the score of Green versus Black.
Yeah. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. And now, back to Hot D. All right, let's move on to Jason B. Says, you said Sir Criston is a hypocrite, but I totally disagree. In his eyes, all women are sacred so long as they are pure and haven't ruined his or their vows. He gave in to temptation and slept with Rhaenyra. In his eyes, Rhaenyra used him and cast him aside without a second thought. He soiled his white cloak and all for nothing. So in his eyes, Rhaenyra is no longer a woman worthy of respect or admiration. I don't get why this is so hard to understand.
It's fair.
I don't know, man. When you say all women are a reflection of the mother, you're getting into the no true Scotsman fallacy, where it's like, sure, that, sure. You know, if you're just like, well, Rhaenyra is not a woman because she's proved herself to be a this or that or the other, you know, like, it's easy to make, you know, a class of people completely blameless and pure if you just carve out all the exceptions and say they aren't this or they aren't that, right?
Right, right.
So, like, I don't know. I think... is it really that hard to understand why a black would have a problem with this behavior? Really? Is it really hard to understand? Like, I can understand where you're coming from and I can articulate it, but like, I don't think it's hard to see the other way as well. But that's why Greens versus Blacks is so much fun. That will conclude the Council of the Blacks and the Greens. We're going to transition into the Maester's Corner, which is not spoilery at all this week. Or at least the part with me and Anthony. John asks, will you be doing any Game of Thrones or Hot D stuff over the long season break? So this is something we are currently working out and planning on. I think the current plan is the yes, I am going to continue with Maester Anthony in some capacity. I know that we've got a rough plan to kind of do some transition material where we do a close reading of where we've gotten in Fire and Blood so far and compare it to the show and kind of identify all the different choose your own adventures that they picked and like the things that they embellished and the things that were kind of right on. I think that'll be interesting. And then eventually Anthony, you know, he just finished Game of Thrones before we got to House of the Dragon. And he's going to resume with the Clash of, no, a Storm of, Clash of Kings, I think is the first one that comes up. So he's going to do a chapter by chapter read of that. I might be participating in those in some capacity. But then regardless, every 10 to 12 weeks, I think Jim and I are going to come back and round up some House of the Dragon / Jon Snow sequel, because, you know, that's something that's been mm-hmm. rumbling. We should start hearing some news out of that production soon, because this Hot D feed is going to contain all A Song of Ice and Fire televised material universe stuff. So
yeah,
just like we did kind of the lead up to Hot D, we're going to start doing that in the off season as well. So there, you know, I think there'll be lots of compelling content if you're a Game of Thrones fan or if you want to keep up on Hot D. And I wonder what fun acronym Jon Snow sequel would be. The JSS. It's just JJSS, just Jon Snow sequel.
Boy, I wonder what the crossover between our Walking Dead and Game of Thrones audience is.
Just Survive Somehow. Just Jon Snow sequel. So yeah, that's the current plan, and it might change a little bit. Also, it's everything is contingent on schedule. So even if I am a regular part of Anthony's podcast, I might have to dip out when we're doing tons of stuff on the other feeds. So none of these are promises. These are just things we're trying to work out. But that's the plan going forward. And without further ado, the Maester's Corner, which is going to be Anthony, it started off with us kind of doing a little bit of minor book versus show, like with the ambiguities, and it turned into a referendum and a test of my green versus black lealness. The answer might shock you. Let's get into the Maester's Corner. Maester Anthony, welcome back to the Maester's Corner.
I'm always happy to visit with you, Aaron.
So, well, thank you. We were conferring about what to talk about because, you know, we're kind of like, you know, there wasn't a lot of deep lore to kind of dig into and unravel in this episode. Right. And you suggested something that I've touched on. And I went back and I listened to our Fire and Blood coverage. We did this like 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's me, you, and Kim Renfro joined for the Dance of the Dragons part. And we talked about it. And one of the things we often remarked on is how you've got this history and you've got this very staid and stolid maester saying, brr, 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 brr. And then you've got this very prudish yeah. septon and they're going, brr, 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 brr. And then you got, Mushroom the Fool that comes in and is like, brr, 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 brr. And, you know, this like that you're never quite sure what's real because they're presenting all this. Although usually Mushroom is always the one that's like, you know, the maesters don't believe. They very much discount. Oh, it's Mushroom being Mushroom. You had the idea of going through the season, you know, we're 9 episodes in. It's only one left.
Yeah.
And kind of like reviewing what we thought we knew, what we definitely know, and what we now think about some of these ambiguities in the text and on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought it would be interesting. So you're going to be the maester, and I'm not sure if I want to be the prudish septon or the fool. Probably a mix of both.
It's an interesting career transition. You know, if we ever saw, I don't know if we've ever seen a maester become a fool or a fool become a maester, but I would imagine that you would need some sort of training, you know, retraining and whatnot.
Which do you think would be more likely and which do you think, you know, would be more entertaining? Like the fool, the maester, or maester to fool?
If Joffrey's king, anyone can become a fool at any time.
That's
true.
You could
just be walking by and all of a sudden you're his new fool.
Yeah, right? Like Grand Maester Pycelle, freshly shorn. High degree of fool hardiness. You know, you could just put a cap, dunce cap on him and have him prance and you get there.
Yeah. Yeah. There's ambiguity in the text, but I think that they've really played into the ambiguities in the show. And I thought this, for me, this kind of spurred when in this most recent episode, Aemond calls his brother a wastrel, which was a new word for me. I'd never heard that word before.
Oh, yeah?
Had you heard that word before?
I had, but I'd never looked up the definition, because every time it's used in context, it's always pretty clear that you're talking about, I guess that's the male version of a flibbertigibbet. I haven't seen the definition yet. So that was my thought.
Yeah, I pulled out my handy Maester dictionary.
Nice.
And there's two definitions for the word wastrel. And one is a wasteful or good for nothing person. I thought, oh yeah, that works. I could see how Aemond might think this of his older brother. I mean, he even wastes his seed at one point.
Sure.
This is a very wasteful person.
The grave sin of Onanism.
Yes. look out for lightning bolts. the second definition of wastrel is a neglected child. And I thought, what a perfect little ambiguity to throw into almost a throwaway line in this episode, where depending on your point of view, you could look at Aegon as either just a waste of space. You know, he's just, he treats the world like his garbage bin or whatever. Or you could look at him as someone who's a result of bad parenting. And, you know, maybe he is a neglected child. Maybe his father never loved him. Maybe his mother has been putting these expectations on him and not really caring about him as a person, only in office. Depending on how you view this particular family, it absolutely changes what you might think is a better definition for wastrel.
Sure.
And for me, that is indicative of a lot of plot elements of this story. And I think, and this is just my suspicion, but I think it might have something to say to the green and black dichotomy that we found in the fandom. So, Aaron, I have put together a very sciency, objective, totally maestery, doesn't reveal me as a green at all survey.
Are you agreeing?
I'm going to ask you, I'm not revealing anything. I'm going to ask you to answer these questions of a survey I put together.
All right.
They each represent some kind of ambiguity in the show. And I'm curious to see how you will answer each of these. I don't know how you're going to answer them. So it'll be interesting to hear how you do that.
Maybe there'll be some ambiguities generated in this segment.
It may be so. Number one. Did Daemon say king for a day in his toast after the death of his nephew? Yes or no?
So are you going to hold me to this yes or no, or can I expound?
You can. I think that the conceit of this is that we hope you will expound.
Gotcha. So I guess it's going to be a 2-minute segment otherwise. So my feelings for Daemon have definitely changed over the season. And before I answer this one, there's another one where there is a scene where Daemon is spying on a small council meeting in the first episode.
Yeah,
and right. He's overhearing Otto harangue the king about how what a shit heel he is. Mm-hmm. And Otto essentially accuses Aemond of plotting regicide. And Viserys says, you think too ill of my brother. My brother doesn't even think about the king. It's being the king. It's too much authority, too much responsibility.
Yeah, he doesn't have that kind of ambition, right?
Yeah, and it cuts to Daemon kind of chuckling to himself. And like at first I interpreted that as the, you know, Daemon thinking that the king himself is being, his brother's being foolish, that he doesn't think that Daemon would kill him or that he's not ambitious. But now that I've seen most of the season, I interpret that as Daemon chuckling of like, Otto, you fool. I would never hurt my brother. You know, like that's such a fun, like that's funny to like the idea that Daemon would do anything to hurt, you know, who he considers his family. I don't think even in his young, most impetuous, shittiest days, I don't think he would contemplate. So I think Daemon almost certainly said king for a day in that toast. But it was much more measured and rueful and sad marking the occasion than a boastful jape.
Yeah, it's sort of more like someone using humor to sort of lighten a somber moment.
Yeah, or even starting off that way because, you know, there's a lot of carousing and whatnot. But in that scene, you could even tell, even that episode, that Damon, you know, he didn't like when Missaria put him on the spot to speak. And, you know, he's trying to think of something clever, something funny. But I think what ends up coming out of his mouth is more heartfelt. And
yeah,
Otto spins that, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. On this point, I think just to reiterate what I probably already said, but I think that the show wants us to notice that omission. Uh-huh. And yeah, I think that the show wants to create a situation where we debate whether he says this or not.
Sure.
Now, you have answered yes, which would be an answer that would be indicative of a Greens answer. But the caveat that you've provided has revealed you as a Black.
I'm pretty, yeah. That was part of my legal service to the podcasting community is to make sure people know that I have a bias towards Black for sure.
Yeah. Right. Interesting that that you've leaned into the ambiguity. You're definitely on the Black side, but you're leaning into the ambiguity.
I'm trying to cut an olive figure, dark green.
Okay. All right. Next question: was Alicent right to keep her relationship with the king a secret from her best friend? Yes or no?
No. I think that was, if you take Otto out of the situation as the most proximate cause, I think Alicent choosing to keep silent about this. But I think I also don't judge her because the king told her, on no certain terms, don't tell your best friend about this. And he's the king, and she's a little girl, and she's on a mission from her dad that scares and confuses her. But no, I think she should have been like, hey, yo, they're trying to put me and your dad together. That's messed up, right? And then Rhaenyra can say what she has to say about it, and they could get all that out. But
yeah, legitimate answers on both sides. You could say she is obeying what the king's wishes are. Right.
She's
doing leal service to her.
Yeah.
Her lord, to the Lord of the Seven Realms or the Seven Kingdoms.
But see, that's the thing. Yeah, being leal, you got to choose your leal too, because that automatically made her not leal to her best friend.
Yeah. Yeah. So the green answer would be yes, she did the right thing. Right. So, but of course, the point to this exercise is to show that there are legitimate answers on both sides. So,
right,
next question: is Otto correct when he says that Rhaenyra's coronation will result in civil war? This is a big one.
See, this is so much of the conflict between Blacks and Greens, because I can tell good King Jim Harris, as much as I've tried to work on him, doesn't really believe that there would be an inevitable civil war with Rhaenyra taking the throne. And I think Martin, you know, throughout Fire and Blood and in this series, is all but screaming, Westeros is super sexist, and no matter what foundation was laid for it, there would be, I'm not sure if it would get to full civil war, but there would almost certainly be a rebellion and an uprising and a succession attempt, which would necessarily lead to violence and bloodshed, just because I keep coming back to this number. Fire and Blood tells us it was 20-1, the amount of lords backing Rhaenys' claim versus Viserys's claim, and how much did things change in 20 to 30 years? Probably not much. So I think that, like, and that's the thing, it's like, it doesn't, Aegon doesn't have to press his claim. That's the important thing I think people need to realize, is that others will press it for him. They'll be like, boo this queen, we want a king. Aegon, look at him, he's blonde, he's Targaryen, he's tall, we don't know anything about his wastrelness. We want him, and lords would prop him up and do violence in his name, whether he wanted it or not. So that's what I think.
Okay, so you're leaning yes on this.
I think Otto is absolutely politically correct in his analysis of the political situation.
This is interesting, because this is a greenish answer. And let me follow up by saying, if the consequence is civil war, whatever Otto does dirty pales in comparison to a civil war, right? I mean, from Varys's point of view, if we bring Varys into this,
see, that's
Varys is very much a consequentialist. He's like, what is going to be the choice? I don't care what you think is ethical. I want to know what choice will save the most common folks' lives.
Well, see, that's where, like, you know, pacifism and pragmatism runs into the face of reality, because, you know, it's good to be anti-war and it's good to be, you know, like, well, we're going to try to make choose the lesser of two evils. Those are all good organizing principles for one's life. But at some point, to make any kind of real progress, you have to stand and fight. You know, you can't just let you can't just be, oh, there's going to be a fight over this. Oh, I guess I'll back down. I'll concede or whatever. That's and one might argue that it would be good for the realm once and for all to sort this question of whether women have a right to rule. Because it probably won't be the only time it comes up and the only time it puts the realm in jeopardy. So, like, kind of like the American Civil War, at some point you can't compromise. You can't look the other way. You can't be like, well, you do it on your side of fence, then we'll do it. You have to stand and fight. And I feel like the correct decision would have been 20 years ago to fully put the might of the realm behind Rhaenyra and prop her up and get her properly groomed for power. And then the die is cast and whatever lords buck against it, you make an example of them and hope it doesn't split the realm into.
Yeah, I think that we've illustrated here that there is a legitimate argument to say Otto's right, and maybe he's a dastardly fellow, regardless, right? But I guess it really comes down to, what do you think the consequences are?
And also, what do you think the hand's responsibility is? The hand is supposed to, you know, do his best to enact the king's will, or is the hand supposed to manipulate things to his liking? Because that's where, you know, Otto's political analysis is correct. It's just that he is not faithful to the king.
Yeah, it's something that Steve and I were talking about a while back. We were like, okay, if you were king, you would want the best political mind as hand, right? And if the answer is right, then you think, what are the chances that that guy's not going to be scheming?
Right? Yeah, guys like Strong, you know, Lord Strong.
You almost want someone that's like a little bit high on, you know, think about like the Westworld, like, you know, intelligence scores versus like their comedy scores or whatever. You almost want your AI that you create to not be the highest political mind, but the highest of sort of their leal service. You want loyalty to outrank the political part of it, but you also want a political mind, right?
You got to have them both. And the political minds probably are pretty ambitious.
That's right.
That's why Lord Strong was so special.
Indeed he was, until he got burned. All right. Yep. Next question. Did Daemon travel to the Vale intending to kill his first wife?
Boy, this is something that they don't even hint at really in the books. This is something that's in the gaps. And I got to say, as filmed, I think he did. I think he's wearing his, what we now know is his crime cloak.
Yeah.
Waiting until his lady wife gets way out into the wilderness where nobody's going to hear or see. And, you know, someone wrote in with an e-feedback that, like, they made a big point of Daemon stinking like dragon. And how that would be so terrifying to a prey species, because we've heard that like Balerion the Black Dread could swallow battle horses and aurochs.
That spooked the horse. Right?
And that, like he stank of dragon, got close, and the horse smelled and terrified and bucked. And the way he kind of approached the horse and kind of put his hand to his snout, I kind of think that, he did.
Interesting.
Also the timing. Like, he wanted to get out of this thing that was a reason that people kept on throwing it in his face. He was wanting to clear the path for Rhaenyra. It seems pretty clear to me.
Interesting, again, that you're choosing a greenish answer. This is very fascinating.
100% leal. I'm telling you, this Lord Commander, he's just doing what's best for the realm. Calling it as he sees it.
Did Rhaenyra lie to Alicent in the Godswood about her night with Daemon? Yes or no?
Yes, 100%. Nothing. I don't know what exactly happened, but nothing is not a fair description of what didn't happen. You know, they all but had penetrative sex.
Okay, interesting. I think that the other view on this would be to say, she's being accused of coupling, right? And she's denying the accusation, and she's right to deny it.
That ain't Leal. yeah. Because that's the thing, is that's why I think Leal is such a great word, because it's not just honest, it's also faithful. You know, okay. Which is not like that. That precludes lies of omission, and I think Rhaenyra. You know, because like if she's going to be like a true friend, she'd be like, look, here's the tea, sis. My uncle awayed me. We went to a pleasure house. Things got hot and heavy. We were kissing. We're making out. It was crazy. And then he just ghosted me. And then I went back to the castle and I fucked Sir Criston.
That'd be the whole truth. Right?
That would be where like Alicent's like, okay. And I think if she said that, Alicent could process it and... But I don't know because that clears Daemon. Like, I don't know. That would be okay, it'd be interesting what the truth would actually do in that situation, because that would literally clear Daemon.
Yeah,
you know, of wrongdoing. It would probably burn Sir Criston Cole. I don't know. It'd be interesting counterfactual. What do you think would happen if Rhaenyra was 100% honest with Alicent that night?
I think that she would. I think it might have mended a lot of misunderstanding between the two going.
But it would have fucked up a lot of things in the realm. Like,
but if you think about Alicent's response, she's moving forward as if she does trust Rhaenyra. So like she goes to her husband and says, your daughter it's not in her nature to lie. Mm-hmm. It is in Daemon's nature to lie.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know if it changes much.
I think maybe it gilds or beheads Sir Criston Cole. And honestly, after seeing him in 9 episodes,
that's true.
Fun fact, Sir Criston Cole, the only character that's been in all 9 episodes. Huh. I've seen a lot of this guy, and I think him gelded at the wall or beheaded is a good look for him, honestly.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. This next question is kind of a parallel to the last question. Did Rhaenyra lie to Rhaenys in the Godswood about her innocence in Lenor's death?
I think she is this is another thing about being honest versus being leal. I think she answered the absolute truth, but there's a lot more to the story.
What she says is literally true, right? Yeah. What she says is literally true, and yet it is intended to conceal a key part of that truth.
And unfortunately for Nier, it's like it would be better for her if she gave the real Leal answer, you know, like actually told, you know, Rhaenys like what actually happened, because Rhaenys, you know, I think Rhaenyra has a reputation for this kind of crap at this point, and Rhaenys is drawing the wrong conclusion from that answer, you know.
Interesting.
She's treating her like Michael Corleone, saying, I didn't have anything to do with it, Kay. I didn't literally pull the trigger. I didn't literally, you know, I didn't literally give somebody an order to a button man. But like, we all know that really Michael is the responsible one for us. So, yeah, I think she told the truth, but she wasn't being leal.
OK, so those last two questions mirrored each other. You took a green and a black. So that you again sort of leaning into the ambiguity for sure. Next question. Did Alicent kill the maidservant who was Aegon's victim? Yes or no?
I think yes. I think if I only go by what's on the screen, 100%, but people have pointed out to me that there's been behind the scenes material, or maybe it's an interview. I still haven't compiled all the feedback, but that's some impression I got, is that one of the showrunners or the director has stated that, like, oh, we didn't intend you to think that. Which I don't give a fuck. I don't, like, there's nothing that a director or a writer can say that will override what was put on the screen. You know, like this was goes back to like when Jaime raped Cersei, and the director and the writer and everybody's like, oh, you know, it's kind of blurry, but still consensual. Like, fuck no, it wasn't. Like, I got eyes, I got ears, I can adjudicate what is on the screen myself. Thank you very much. And I do. Yeah, I do. I think Allison kills the maidservant.
Okay, let me push back a little bit on this just to see where it goes. All right, this episode, this last episode, she's debating the ethics of murder with her father. And Otto's saying, look, this is for the good of the realm. This is a sacrifice for the realm. And she said, it is not weakness to be reluctant to murder. Is it possible? I mean, of course, the show's leaning into the ambiguity, but I'm just like putting my thumb on the other scale and saying, she's really laying into this poor girl really hard on not telling it, you know, telling anyone outside the room. Is it possible that she does just give the girl moon tea and then spirit her away to Dorne or something like that?
Yeah, it's possible. And I wouldn't call someone an idiot that believes that. I just think that when you have a person saying, you know, how can we know that you won't tell anybody? And she's like, I won't. And you give her a bag of gold and a mysterious substance and then say, hey, this is the only way to be sure. Those logically connect. The child thing is only there by inference. Yeah. But like if the literal connection is, how do I know you won't tell? This is the only way to be sure. I think and the fact that that Diana was noticeably absent later in the episode.
She's in Dorne. She's hanging out on the beach in Dorne, man.
She's enjoying her retirement. She's on the
This one is a little bit goofy because Alicent acts horribly either way.
Well, right? The thing is like she says it's not a weakness
to silence a victim, right?
She says it's not a weakness to be reluctant to murder, but she can and will murder. She's just reluctant. It's just like it's the last thing she wants to do, but she'll do it if she has to. And I think she felt in this situation she has to.
All right. Well, interesting. You're leaning definitely black on that one.
It's pretty. That's my blackest answer yet.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. For the record, I don't think she did. I don't think she killed her. I entertain the notion. I think I don't think she's got a taste for murder. I think that's why Laris is around.
It ain't easy being green, brother. It ain't easy being green. Like the frog said.
next one, that wise old frog. Was Vaemond justified in his accusations of Rhaenyra's children? Yes or no?
Yes, he's literally correct. He's literally correct. Rhaenyra is treasonous. She has put bastards in line for the throne. She's defrauding the realm. And he's just telling out loud what everyone knows as the unvarnished truth.
And as a result of her deceit, his line is going to end.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the green position, and they're right. Like, if we're going to count coup and, or count, or whatever, count our chips and see who's got the best claim, Rhaenyra fucked up as soon as she put bastard children in line for the throne, because that's already treason. So anything that Otto does and Allison does as a response is responding to that original treason. But then you got to go, it's like, well, then, you know, is Aegon actually better than and that's where you start getting into sticky stuff. But Vaemond's justified. He just wasn't wise.
That's true. Not politically wise, but he's right. The one guy in the room that's at least speaking the truth. Right. And of course, as a result of that, Daemon straight up murders him, right? Probably with the king would have been fine with that, but you know, Viserys doesn't have a taste for murder either. You know, he's not a guy that pulled the trigger of Viserys.
No, he would have pulled the guy's tongue. I think he for sure would have cut the guy's tongue out, but he wasn't too mad, obviously, of Daemon slopping his head off, because he certainly
was it. Anyway, so it's interesting. All right, so you're giving more of a greenish answer on this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the next one really doesn't have a good, like a yes or no answer, but I will say it anyway. Aemond uses the term wastrel of his brother. Which of the following definitions of wastrel describes Aegon better? A wasteful or good for nothing person, or a neglected child Or is it meant to, or are both definitions accurate?
I think a better definition for Aegon is a wasteful or good for nothing person, because, man, that's the question. Like, let's take like helicopter parents. Are you familiar with that term?
Absolutely. So
these parents that hover over their children.
From time to time, I've definitely helicoptered.
Right. You start off early, 3 years old, and your kid gets a fight in the playground. You go and straighten everything out. And you, in elementary school, you ask the teacher to you know, give him leniency for this. And then you are calling, you know, when they graduate and they go through college, you're leaning on their professors to do this, that. And they're just overly involved. The child, is that neglecting a child? Because
it's the opposite, most
psychologists, you're suffocating them, right?
I think there's evil on both extremes, right?
But it's certainly not neglect, and I think that's what I come down with Aegon, that he wasn't neglected. It seems like Viserys had took an interest in him, watched his training, was kind of delighted in his children just in general, and Alicent certainly spent a lot of time and effort on him. It's just that she, you know, I kind of got a little bit of familiarity what it's like to have a hyper religious mother that's got plans for your future. And that can definitely fuck you up, but I don't think neglect. I don't think it's neglect. I think it's
Because I think when he says he laughs. He's like, no, he did not say that I was the next king. My father hated me. And I think that's not necessarily neglect either, but I do think that there's something about.
Why do you think he felt that way? Because I never got a single thing where Viserys hated him.
I mean, reasonable people can disagree, but I think Viserys was generally a good guy. I think Aegon is a total ass, and I think that there's probably some friction there.
Huh. Yeah. Could be.
I don't know. I mean, whatever the case is, he thinks that his father hated him. I think that was an authentic statement.
Yeah. On the screen, it seems like he never did that. And every time he talked about, like, when he was yelling at his family to be, it's like he always mentioned how much he loved them all. And that's the reason why he was doing this, is because he just loved all these faces. And so it's like maybe Viserys never actually hugged him and said, I love you, son. But,
Okay. So you're leaning black a little bit on this. But I think that it's interesting. This next one is the last one. And I think this is just the most interesting question on the survey. What did Alicent say after she calls Aegon an imbecile? Does she say, I'll give you three possibilities. You come up with your own if you want. You imbecile, do your duty. Or does she say, you imbecile, of course I love you. Or does she say nothing?
I made an analogy to Fiddler on the Roof on this one, you know, how Tevye and Goldie are, you know, after when doing all the.
That is way, way. I don't think Alicent has that Tevye bone in her body. I don't think Alicent and Tevye are even in the same league.
But no, it's like, you know, because like in here, Tevye is like asking his wife, it's like, you know, we were put together. We're an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. Do you actually love me? And like she keeps dodging the question.
It is one
like,
of the most touching moments in all of acting.
Yeah. She's like, for 25 years, I've washed your clothes. I've cooked your meals. Yeah. I've cleaned your house. I've given you children. I milked your cows. After 25 years, why are you asking me about love right now? You imbecile. She doesn't say
if
that.
That's not love. She says, if that's not love, what is? Right.
Right. That's the end.
I think that's what Golda says to Tevye is basically, you know, that answer. It's like, you imbecile, of course I love you. But it's almost like it's like Golda is a little bit perplexed by the question. My sense is that Alicent is like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, you've got to do your duty here. What does my love have to do with anything?
That's an interesting interpretation. If I just read that off the script, I'd be not. But like Olivia Cooke, unfortunately, puts a little bit of sparkle in her eye and a smile on her face and warmth in her tone. And I interpret it very much of like, if, you know, for 20 years, I've murdered your handmaids that you've deflowered. I've put a awning under your window to catch all your spill seed. Yeah. And I've interceded between you and your father. And I tried not to get you killed. And if that's not love, what is? Like, I think, you know, that's where it went.
Okay, well, it's interesting.
Because also Aegon in the next scene answer does not seem to be giving whole... like, my mother told me she never loved me, kind of. Like, he seems to be scared about the crown, but, you know, I don't know. That's what I think.
Okay, well, it's interesting. Your last answer leans green. And so, scientifically, we have now proven that Maester Aeron is 100% Leal.
Leal for what? Leal for green?
You are absolutely leaning... in equal parts black and green, according to my survey.
Good.
Yeah.
That means my brain is still functioning. Oh my God.
You're leal to the bald move community. that's what my sciency, absolutely maestery survey has proven.
What kind of metal is the Maester's link for Aeronology? Because I think you just forged it.
Yeah, we just forged you a new link.
It's tin. Tin and aluminum.
Unfortunately, it's balsa wood.
Yeah, not very sturdy. Not very sturdy, that link.
So I thought it was an interesting, and I just want to reiterate, if you're listening, the whole point of this exercise is to say that the show means to leave out key parts of the plot and make you decide. And of course, you're going to bring your own confirmation biases to the story, and how you'd make these decisions tells you a little bit more about yourself and not necessarily everything you need to know about the character on the screen.
True. You bring a lot of baggage into this. And what I really admire about the show and what I never expected them to do is how faithful that is to the tone of the book, where you're never really quite sure, even when the Maester comes out and says something happened, if it really happened that way and why. Because there's so many differing details, and the details are not like the exact what that happened, although sometimes you get, like, this Green Council is fascinating because no one, there is no kind of eyewitnesses to what happened in there. So it's all out of, but like, you sometimes, a lot of times know what happened, but you don't know why and for what reason. You know, because like that's where mushrooms, like, oh, they're just horny. And the Septon's like, oh, it's because, you know, they had a religious conflict. And the Maester's like, oh, because it's politically advantageous. And I love how House of the Dragon is retaining that quality in Fire and Blood by just never making it so debatable what's happening and kind of doing that. And that's why, one of the reasons I think the community is reacting so strongly to it, because there is usually you can just beat someone up with canon. Like, in this scene, on this page, on this paragraph, they said this, and you said they said this, and that means you're wrong. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more shades of gray in this show. I think it's great.
Absolutely. Anyway, I just think that this exercise really revealed a lot. I think that we both took some risks. I think depending on how this went, we could have ended our friendship right here. But I think we're both better for the experience. So
did
I
have sex
you
with Sir Christian Cole in The Godswood, Anthony? Tell me true.
No, I can literally say that we never kissed.
Okay. Well, you know, Maester Anthony's not given to lies. So
I didn't tell you the entire truth, but I will say that he never kissed me on the mouth.
No, I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get some nice juicy lore that we can dig into for the final episode.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's been fun. And tell people that what are you excited for people to enjoy coming out of the Anthony cinematic universe?
I think that a lot of our listeners already know that I've got a podcast called Cocoons of Horror, where we cover film. And this week, I covered The Green Knight, the 2021 film, The Green Knight, with the world's foremost expert on medieval knights.
Damn, that's cool.
So, yeah. So it's me and Carol Parrish Jameson. If you're interested in that, by the way, great film. But if you're interested in that, you can search for Cocoons of Horror wherever you search for podcasts.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, we'll see you next week for another Maester's Corner. Later.
See ya.
Okay, we're done with the Maester's Corner, but as we sometimes do, we've got a little bit more like lore feedback, things I want to talk about. I do want to say, again, I don't consider this a spoiler unless you've read the books. I mentioned last week I had a couple of hypothetical situations that could happen in the next two episodes. I am extremely confident that my two dudes on a mission being hindered by a third dude is going to happen this week, and it's going to be pretty spectacular. I'm not sure about the two dudes reprisal. That could be an end of episode hammer, in which case people's minds will be blown. It could also be saved as an early next season kind of like, you know, splash moment. So I'm not sure about that, but I'm ready to stake a lot on the two dudes on a mission being hindered by a third dude. So keep your eyes peeled for that prophecy to come true. Let's move on to Tom. Says, I'd be interested to hear whether you think viewers would enjoy the show more if they read Fire and Blood up until the timeline of the current episode, and if so, how much of the book would that be? So I've been repeating numbers that I've heard on other podcasts and stuff, and I think there's different ways to judge how much material from Fire and Blood is in House of the Dragon. I think a lot of people are keeping count and they're skipping all the prologue. But if you start on the page of the book where the old king Jaehaerys convenes the Great Council, and you go all the way to at least the aftermath of the Dance of Dragons. So it starts on 344, this Great Council, and it ends at page 590. That's 246 pages out of a 700-some page book. We are currently, and as of episode 9, on page 402. I mentioned that the last few weeks have really started turning the pages. So we've done 58 pages out of 246. Will you enjoy the show more? I don't know, because it seems almost universal before we saw the show from people that read Fire and Blood that, like, the Dance of the Dragons was a little dull. It was very thin characters introduced pages before they would either die or do something important. Two very vain and kind of haughty people, jockeying for just naked power. The show has done so much better a job at fleshing out the motivations and the relationships and frankly adding and embellishing things that, you know, one of the reasons it took us like five episodes to get through 14 pages is because they're just making so much stuff up, making up so many more motivations and never directly contradicting the canon mostly. So like, if I could hand you right now a 3-page or like a 10-page outline with bullet points of every major plot point that's going to happen in the next 3 to 4 seasons, and I said, this is 100% accurate, would you read it? Or would you be like, you know what? I'd rather wait for the show.
Because yeah, you're so dry.
You're very close to getting that by reading the books.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's been really fun because of the way the book is written as a choose your own history, where it's like, you know, Maester this said this, Septon this, and then Mushroom says this. It's been really fun as a book reader to see which of those things that they're kind of lean into, and sometimes how they kind of like go between, you know, like try to mesh those opinions. It's been really fun and satisfying. So like both would work, but if you're this far and you haven't read, I honestly would not read it. Or you could also read up until the point that you're at now, because like there is a lot of interesting background about, like, you know, Jaehaerys and his queen and the Aegon the Conqueror and stuff like that. But do you want to read 344 pages to properly understand the Dance of Dragons' place in Targaryen history? You got 100 years of not a lot going on to get to that point. You know, you got Maegor the Cruel. He's kind of interesting, but the long 50 plus year reign of Jaehaerys where it's peaceful and that, you know, that's like, yeah, but I don't know. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there. I just can't make that decision for you. Marcus wants to know, Aaron, I want to know if you'd consider expanding the Maester's Corner into a full-fledged spoiler episode again. If not that, then maybe doing one big spoiler episode at the end of each season to discuss the upcoming events in the dance and all the fun theories that go along with it. I think there's so much to talk about, and I loved your spoiler editions during the original series. The spoiler theories don't just have to be about the dance either. I think it'd be fun to take a look at past events and do a deeper dive in older lore. I think the only problem for me is that, like, I did, like, what, 27 of these spoiler episodes, and I had to abandon it, in even though they're very popular, in season 7 and 8, because I just kind of ran out of new stuff to talk about. Mm-hmm. And since George has stubbornly refused to write another fucking book, that remains the case a decade later. I think I did, like, we did... When it's appropriate to do like a spoiler where it's like, oh, this is, you know, it's like, oh, we got these eggs. Is it Dane? But it's like just really minor stuff. If there ever comes up where there's a big thing or this show really adds to the lore or changes our mind about, like, you know, what things happen in the Game of Thrones main trilogy or not trilogy, main series, I'd probably do that. But it wouldn't be something I could sustain. There's just no way. There's not enough new material being made. So, but yeah, I, if it makes sense, I would resurrect that, for sure. And the other thing is, like, the other crucial thing that's different is, like, one of the magics of the spoiler is, like, you had this where you had five books loaded with all these crazy details and the show confirming, denying some of them, but you didn't know the ending. So there was a lot of fun to speculation. There is no speculation about the end of Dance of Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get to page, what did I say? You get to page 590 and that's it. That's it. Unless the show just completely, and I don't think with George as the executive producer, you're going to see them just discard all of his shit like we did with Game of Thrones. Because, like, there's nothing wrong with the dance. Yeah. It's just a little dry because it's just big action sequences by people that you don't really know or care or love about. I fucking love mm-hmm. a bunch of people in this show now. So,
mm-hmm.
Finally, we got Matt from Good Lad UK. Says, my question is about how strong the potential connections to the Game of Thrones series. With Lord Lyonel and Sir Harwin dead, this makes Lord Larys the only remaining member of House Strong. My question is this. In the original Game of Thrones series, Cersei/Qyburn names the reanimated corpse of Sir Gregor Clegane as Sir Robert Strong when making him as part of King Tommen's Kingsguard. Is there some connection between this new name for the mountain and the House Strong we have on House of the Dragon? We've already seen Lord Larys in scenes in the Black Cells of the Red Keep as Lord Confessor, and the Black Cells is where Qyburn took Sir Gregor's body for his experiments. It seems Larys Strong is a master of whisperers of sorts, and this is also a position that Qyburn held in Game of Thrones. If Larys is a Greenseer, he could be living on in Qyburn after greenseeing out of his body at the time of his eventual death in the House of the Dragon timeline. Oof.
Whoa.
That's 200 years of warging he would have to be. But I don't know if he's a powerful enough greenseer.
What tree has he grown into? That's what I want to know.
My theory may be spiraling, but there's too many similarities between Larys and Qyburn along with the use of the name Strong for it all to be a coincidence. What are your thoughts? So, he actually sent this to me last week, and I'm like, this is actually kind of cool. It's first I've heard of it, so I need to do a bit of research. And I have, and it doesn't seem like there's any clear answers. The consensus seems that this is either a private joke for Qyburn or like an open affront or challenge. And it goes like this. The private joke theory works out that Qyburn spent significant times in Harrenhal. That's where we found him at the start, you know, of us coming to his acquaintance in Game of Thrones. Very slight spoilers, but I can say that House Strong never really recovers from the treachery that Larys dealt them, and then the overall participation in the dance, and this house is going to go extinct in the future. By the time you get to Game of Thrones, there is no House Strong left. They're like the reigns of Castamere. They're just gone.
Okay.
It's likely that Qyburn, serving in Harrenhal, who was one, you know, the Strongs were one of the lords of that castle, knows about this. So it's an irony to him that he's resurrecting a dead knight and giving him the name of a zombie house, effectively resurrecting them both. The open challenge angle is that since House Strong is a dead house, but is relatively storied, they had two Hands of the King to their name. We've seen Lyonel. There's another one. And you also had a member of the Kingsguard who's fairly infamous, Sir Lucamore the Lusty. When we talk about the Kingsguard.
That's a bad nickname for a Kingsguard. Okay.
Right. Well, he's one of the ones the Lord Commander had to geld because he couldn't keep his sword sheathed.
Ah, he earned it.
Right. So the Strongs are kind of like a Kennedy type name. It's a famous political name in Westeros. So people know about
Kennedy
how keeps strong.
The sword sheathed. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. People, the lords will know about how strong, the fact that it's a dead house. So when you get this 8 foot tall giant Robert Strong, it's essentially the Lannisters thumbing their nose at the lords and saying, yeah, we know what we did. You know what we did. We dare you to openly speak of it. And in fact, there's like the very closing of Dance of Dragons. There's some internal dialogue, some interior dialogue of Kevin Lannister, where he's essentially putting all this together and knows about it, but also knows he's not going to say anything about it. So I think this theory holds a lot of weight. Finally, I did find some evidence that there's not a zero number of sellswords and Essos that go around styling themselves as Strongs, because it's an important family name that people know of, and there's no one around to defend it or challenge them. So they're like, oh, yeah, weird. Turns out I'm the bastard or long lost of, and I'm keeping the Strong name alive. And that's, you know us, we're Kingsguard and we're.
Right. It's a good selling point if you're a mercenary.
Yeah. I feel like there's a show that we saw somebody take a famous last name, and it was for that reason, that like no one is around to challenge it. I can't remember what it was. It might have been the Gilded Age. But anyway, it might be the sneaky attempt to make people think, you know, that like Qyburn's like, well, I know there's sellswords over there in Essos. There's no Strongs over here. This giant just comes over out of nowhere. Ah, we might have got him from Essos. You know, he was one of the best sellswords in Essos or whatever. So, but in the end, it's just one of those Song of Ice and Fire mysteries where we may never know the correct answer. And that's going to do it for our feedback episode this week. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you'd like to send us feedback for next week, the finale episode, hotd@baldmove.com is where you want to do that. Of course, twitter.com/baldmove is where you want to follow to find out what all we're releasing. We talk about tons of movies. In fact, we're going to do a first run review of Black Adam, the new DCU Dwayne The Rock Johnson vehicle tonight. If you want to keep up on all of our doings, all of our movies, all of the TV shows we cover, twitter.com/baldmove is the best place for that. Finally, if you'd like to support us, support.baldmove.com is how you do that. If you want to get in on this finale episode, it's going to be probably a banger. I'm going to predict a banger episode. If you want to discuss it live with us, that's the only way to do it. Support.baldmove.com and enjoy ad-free feeds and tons of other bonus content. And we appreciate your support. It keeps the bits flowing and our pods casting. That'll do it, as I said, until Sunday night when we do the instant take and instant talk live for club members. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Keep it legal.